Since it's now 3 o'clock, we will convene the Rules of Elections and Public Affairs Committee.
On time.
since it's now 3 o'clock. And we will go first to House Bill 2670 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2670. Mr. Moore, can you give us an overview of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 2670A. The bill directs the county treasurer to the city of money directed to school districts. However, there are two amendments to this bill, both of which replace the original bill. The dash two amendments replace the bill and encourage school districts to use the kindergarten through sixth grade character first educational series or any other similar program to enhance in a positive way the character development of students. The dash three amendment replaces the original bill as written and requires school district boards to provide transportation for school related activities, permit school district boards to provide boarding room, and define terminology related to the bill, and defines residency of a pupil. And we also have a video to go with this exact 5-minute testimony.
All right. And I believe Senator Starr is here to testify.
Is that right? Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this Senator Charles Starr, Senate District 5, Western Washington County. We are all well aware of the problems of safety in our public schools, and there's been a lot said and about how we might address the epidemic of school violence. And we're talking about addressing the symptoms of the problem primarily and not the problem itself, and that is a lack of training of our young people. And I believe that since 1929, the state of Oregon has had on its law, in statute, a law that says that we will teach moral values, those character traits that would address the issue of being a positive influence in our society and a contributing member of our society. We've not done a good job of that, and only recently has it become real fashionable to talk about character training in our public school. The State Department of Education now has come forward with recommendations for character education. There's no better illustration or example of that character education than the Character First Education Program that is the subject of the Dash 8-2 amendments to House Bill 2670. These Character First curricula are well developed and widely used, and I have in my hand an example of that curricula, and some of the materials from that curricula have been handed out to you as part of the testimony. I believe that if we are truly to address the issue affecting the lives of our young people that most affect them the rest of their lives, it is that we teach them character first. And a program such as this, which is, in fact, a copyrighted program, it's not our intent to mandate that a copyrighted program be used, but in fact that it is used as an illustration of what is available, and that we would hope that an adoption of the Dash 8-2 amendments, we send the message that a program similar to this is what is needed to instruct our young people. There are many people here. In fact, the program is being used in the state of Oregon at the present time, and there are people here to talk to you about that who have been personally involved and understand its impact after 1 year of public instruction. I gave to the committee members and handed out for materials also the material extracted from the website Baton Rouge Character First Education Program and how a community has adopted this program for use in public schools, the private schools, in the churches, and they've adopted a strategy that the program might be used not alone, not as a standalone, just in the public school system, but as a program for the whole community. That as children are being taught, the adults also are learning, having an opportunity. So there are many ways that this may be implemented. Our desire is to see that the materials, the information about the materials, be made available to the public schools of our state. We believe that it can be made available and used within the system, that it will save untold, multiplied millions of dollars in future costs of remediating what is the outworking of a lack of character training in our youth today. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have that I'm able to answer. But I commend to you those people who have signed up to testify on the bill who have actually experienced the character first training program, either in their schools or through their own experiences. So with that, I'm open to answer any questions you might have.
Questions, Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator, for bringing this today. And I assume you're here to encourage us to adopt the -2 amendments. Could you just describe a couple of things? One is, I know the way the language is written, this is just an encouragement for school districts to pick this up, so that doesn't mandate anything. But it's a nod from us. I think one of the things that I've always tried to figure out with bills like these is, and I think the impetus is right, that this is the right thing to encourage. When we talk about character, how do you instill some of these things outside of the school? I mean, to me, one of the problems we often see is we're asking schools to pick up a lot of what, in my mind, parents should be instilling. And if they're not successful, whatever it is, then we tend to blame them. I guess I'm trying to figure out where the balance is. I don't disagree with what you're trying to do here. I guess I'm trying to figure out how you balance what's required at schools and what we're trying to give them a basic education, and these values are very important, and yet a lot of that should be coming from the home.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Edwards. I appreciate that question, and you're absolutely right. Our problem is that over our recent history, because of lack of training in so many other avenues, we really need to train parents today, not just the children. And that's why I think community programs like Baton Rouge is undertaken is a tremendous program. But I think by beginning in our schools, that we begin to train up then a generation that knows, and the fact that many of these values have not been taught for so long, either in the church or in the home, that we've gotten these values. And it's necessary to have a beginning somewhere. And I think beginning at the kindergarten through the first 6 grades is a place to start. I'm further convinced that if our children are learning these things, then they're going to be sharing them with their parents. And so we'll have a reverse education program going on. So I think it's a win-win. It's a fantastic opportunity to begin something that will make a difference in the days immediately ahead.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the committee members, at your place, there was a letter from the Customized School District Superintendent, and also a letter from the publisher editor of the Tuscan IT. And if I might highlight what's happening in Tuscan as related to this program, and it's not just in the schools, but it's the whole community that's taking hold of this idea. And we also have a police officer from Tuscan here to testify as well. And if you're right, this would be the parent-driven, that I mean, it's worked at least in class tonight in Baton Rouge, because it's the whole community that's still together.
Thank you, Senator. One last question. You said that this Character First is it an organization? I mean, can you give us a little more information about it?
The Character First started as an education program by the CEO of the Fortune 500 company. And he felt that there was a need for character training within his business. And it was so successful in his business that he and others saw that there was a possibility of developing a program for schools. And that's how this came into being. It's a family-owned and operated company in Oklahoma. And I think I'm hopeful, at least, that among the materials that were distributed to you, we got a copy of this. We didn't do that? Yeah, it should be in the materials that the committee administrator put together. It has my cover letter on the front. And tell us about the where this originated and how it came into being, and it's now been adopted statewide in the state of Florida. It's being used in schools in many states across the nation. It just happens that a small community of Clatskanie in Oregon is the first community in Oregon, and I'm here to tell you that Clatskanie, Oregon, is going to be a model for the Northwest because of what has happened just in this past couple of years as they've embarked on this program. Further questions? Hold on.
Thank you, sir.
Get back to my committee.
Let me ask you a question for you.
Okay.
Well, less of a question than a comment and a thank you. Senator, I'd like to thank you for bringing this to us. Along with Representative Starr. House Bill 2437, which has not moved, which I filed at the request of Judge Robert Y. Thornton, amends a 1927 law, which had a more limited statement in it, but which required, in effect, that school districts teach youngsters honesty, morality, courtesy, obedience to law, respect for the national flag, the Constitution of the United States, in the Constitution of the State of Oregon, respect for parents in the home, the dignity and necessity of honest labor, and other lessons that tend to promote and develop an upright and desirable citizenry, along with some other things, including, by the way, the humane treatment of animals. The bill required school districts in its ultimate form to at least report annually on the implementation of these kinds of education programs. What I see happening here with House Bill 2670 and the proposed amendments is a re-energizing, a redirection, without a requirement, without a mandate, without a report requirement, of this concept in a broader sense. And, Senator, I think it's important that we get this word out to schools and communities that these are the kinds of programs we need, not because the school is a substitute for good parenting, but it is a necessary supplement to good parenting. And with the amount of time youngsters spend in school, unless their efforts are buttressed by the school system, we will find that children will not develop appropriately. And I wanted to make those remarks, Mr. Chairman, while Senator Starr was here, and rather than when we were debating the bill. And I thank you, Senator, for bringing this to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll call Brad Paisley.
Okay.
Paisley. And Carissa Gay. Do you mind coming up together? Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Officer Brad Pasley, and I'm a police officer for the city of Clatskanie. Good afternoon, Chair Simmons, and to the rest of the committee. If I could give you some real brief background before I start, I would like to say that the Courage for First program. I've had some direct experience with it. Last fall, I had the opportunity to attend a law enforcement leadership committee conference, which the focus was character first, as far as how character is vital and how character can be used within the workplace. And currently, my police department is using this program, and it is working out very well. I'd like to start by saying today that I'm attending your hearing today to show support for the Character First Education Series. I believe this program will give our children the resources they need as they navigate through life. In the real world, things do not always go as we hope. Sometimes difficult circumstances are our own fault, but sometimes we find ourselves in a mess we had no way to avoid. In either case, once a problem is upon us, we must respond. It is too late to change the past, and we cannot step into a future time when everything has already blown over. We must accept present circumstances and deal carefully with them today. I believe that Character First Training is a valuable resource for everyone. Character First Training is identifying specific character qualities such as truthfulness, attentiveness, alertness, and compassion, and knowing the operational differences of each one. Character training is listening to my conscience and cooperating with them when it tells me what is right and what is wrong. Character training is developing an inward discipline and restraint for my thoughts, words, actions, and attitudes. It has also learned how to carry out the golden rule in every area of life, such as doing unto others as we have them do unto us. I have attended some of the training programs in the Clatskanie Elementary School. The students ranged from first grade to fifth, enjoyed and responded enthusiastically to the interactive lessons and entertaining stories. Each lesson and each story focused on one specific character quality, for example, such as obedience, patience, or self-control. I will give you one real example of how Character First is working in my community. Yesterday, I spoke to an 11-year-old boy as he walked from school to home. I asked him if he participates in the Character First program at school. With a smile on his face, he said yes. I asked the boy, what would he say to someone if he was asked what the Character First program means to him? He said, and I quote, "Character teaches me not to tease other kids and how to help others." I believe that this boy is beginning to develop his character with positive attributes. I urge you to adopt the proposed amendment 2 to HB 2670 and encourage school districts throughout our state to implement a character education program.
Thank you very much, Officer.
Go ahead. Hi. I'm a 19-year-old student from Tigard, Oregon, and I've been involved with Character First in a number of ways for the past 2 years. In 1998, I went to Oklahoma and for 6 weeks taught there in the elementary schools of Oklahoma City. And then this past year, I've been involved with the Character First program out in Clatskanie. Currently, Character First has been used in about 20 different states and several hundred school districts. But I'd like to briefly share what the 3 key ingredients of Character First are. The first is the curriculum that Senator Starr showed, which this is part of Series 1, and each series contains 9 booklets, each highlighting one character quality. Eventually, there will be 5 different binders covering a total of 45 character qualities, so an elementary school could implement one series each year for the entire time a child goes through elementary school. But each of the colorful booklets inside contains stories and songs and projects that define and illustrate and then apply what the character quality is. For example, the children learn that an African lion is always truthful. And you can tell by looking at the African lion that it's truthful by looking at its eyes and its ears and its nose. And by looking at those things, you can tell if that lion is just out for a nice walk or if he's going to eat you for lunch. And you can depend on the African lion because it's always truthful. And so illustrations like from nature or from various men and women throughout history who have demonstrated character qualities, those are used to reinforce to the children the importance of having those character qualities. And the curriculum also has full-size posters and individual character cards that serve as visual reminders of the character qualities. The average cost for the program is about $3 to $7 per student, so it's not an exorbitant fee that way. But the thing that's most unique about Character First is its flexibility, because it's been used in many different time frames and schedules in schools, where some use it like on one character quality per month for 9 months, whereas others use it for an intense 18-week type course. So it can be varied to meet whatever the needs that the school has to be accomplishing their goals. But the most powerful thing about the curriculum itself is that it's very applicable. All the character qualities have 5 I will statements that the children learn of how they can have that character quality. So, for example, for attentiveness, they learn that they can show attentiveness by looking at others when they talk, by not having distracting behaviors with their hands or their arms, by sitting or standing up straight rather than slouching, by asking questions when they don't understand things. So there's very concrete ways that the children learn to demonstrate each of the character qualities. And that's what makes Character First have such an impact, because it's practical in that way. The second important part of Character First is the character coaches. In Class Kenai, there was a group of about 20 students from all over Oregon, and even a few came from Washington, that were volunteers that came and taught the children stories and songs that would reinforce what the teachers were already sharing with the children about character. As a character coach, both in Class Kenai and in Oklahoma, I got to do a lot more, though, than just teach lessons about character. I got to play on the playground with the kids and help in the office with projects, or even do tutoring for children one-on-one. And really, there's so many opportunities that way to really serve and meet the needs of the school officials. So the ultimate goal of having the character coaches is to give the kids examples of character lived out right before their lives, because character really is more caught than taught. And it's by seeing those examples that they learn the most about character. But the most important part about Character First is really the children themselves. And as they see the enthusiasm of the teachers and the character coaches coming in and teaching about character, they get excited about character too. I can remember my last class in Class Kenai this year. It was a first grade class, and we just learned the 5 I wills for the character quality of virtue. And we learn it in a little rhyme so the kids can remember it better. And I challenged them afterward and said, you know, we've learned lots and lots of rhymes, but I think on this rhyme, you could learn to say it faster than you've said any other rhyme before. And they got so excited about that, we timed them, and at first they just said it in like 30 seconds. But I said, you know, I think you can do it even faster than that. And so we set the stopwatch, and they said it even faster. And those kids were ecstatic that they could say that rhyme in less than like 19 seconds. So it was neat to see their excitement about learning about character. But the enthusiasm that they have isn't just for when they're at school, because lots of kids would go home and share with their families what they learned about character, and the school received numerous calls from parents saying, we really like what you're teaching about character. And so it really became a continual education in that way. In conclusion, I'd like to share with you directly from the mouths of the children their comments about Character First. And these are taken from Valentine's that were given to a Class Kenai character coach by a third grade class. It says, dear character coach, I like you coming to our school. You can stay here forever. I will always tell the truth, even if it will be hard. Happy Valentine's Day, your friend Randy. Dear Character First Coach, thank you for your advice about being good to our friends. I wish I could be like you someday when I grow up. I will always be kind like you. I wish you could come here every day. Your friend, Joel. So the three important parts of character-first education are the curriculum that makes character practical to everyday situations, the coaches that demonstrate that character, and the children who are given tools to be successful in whatever they do.
Thank you very much. Officer, how long has the character-first program been utilized in Sacramento?
Approximately like the last 6 months.
Are you noticing any decrease in vandalism, or is it too soon to tell, or is it what grade level is it being taught to?
My understanding is that it's being taught between the first grade and the fifth grade.
Okay.
I think it probably is too soon to be able to measure any decline in criminal mischief or vandalism, theft, things of this nature. But I do know that with my experience with character, such as honesty, things of this nature, when I speak to kids, when they happen to be caught stealing or things of this nature, they seem to be more forthright that, yeah, they did steal something, or, yeah, they shouldn't have hit somebody, or, yeah, they shouldn't have, you know, perhaps done this. So I think with time, with the constant exposure of the positive quality, that I think the kids will definitely that there will be an immeasurable improvement.
Well, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Questions, Edwards?
Thank you. Thank you for testifying. Has any parents raised any concern about this program in your community?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, thank you very much for driving down. That is your brother that was in fact tonight. He's out of town. And thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
We've got a couple of Senator Farioli to testify in this bill, and I think that Senator Beck also want to testify in this bill. So if you gentlemen want you got to come up. Okay. Mr. Beck has dash 4, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ted Farioli, and I'm here to ask you to consider Council 2670-A3 amendments. And the purpose of the -A3 amendments are to allow a school in Mitchell, the Mitchell Unified School District Number 55, actually it's the high school in Mitchell, Oregon, to consider the dormitory cost in lieu of their transportation cost. And let me explain a little about the character and ambiance of Wheeler County, in case you haven't been to Wheeler County. Wheeler County is one of the larger counties in the state of Oregon, and it has one of the smallest populations. There's about 1,500 people that live in Wheeler County. And Mitchell is one of the three communities in Wheeler County. And the high school there, for some time, has maintained a dormitory program to allow students to participate in high school without spending an inordinate amount of time riding a bus. It's been a really workable solution to take the students and actually put them at the high school. It gives students an opportunity to participate in after-school sports that wouldn't exist if they had to spend a commute time on the bus. It also relieves the parents of very difficult transportation logistics that exist in remote areas, such as Wheeler County. It also provides a very intensive learning experience for students, and we find that some of the students that are enrolled there come from backgrounds where an intensive education opportunity benefits them directly. So we have received this request from the superintendent of Mitchell School District that asked us to allow the Mitchell Unified School District, and to my knowledge, committee members, this would apply to just one school district in the state of Oregon, to consider the dormitory costs in lieu of their transportation costs. As you know, we are offered the transportation allowances for each student that's in our school that has transportation. And what the amendment does is allow that a school district may provide the board and room and a facility that already existed by July 1st, 1998, or a replacement facility for that facility. So it's a sort of a very narrowly focused. So the students attending the district school through an inter-district agreement or through a power of attorney could be counted in the transportation equation so that their dollars that would have been spent driving them around the district in the bus could be used to include the cost of the board and room at the school. It's a fairly straightforward amendment. It basically would commence with the 1998-1999 school year. It does affect the state school fund distribution commencing with that year. And it will, in fact, allow the continuation of a high school admission. And there is only approximately 35 to 40 students that go to high school in Mitchell, and about 15 of them are boarded. So the potential to have this dormitory on campus and the benefits that it brings to the school are really dependent on our ability to use the transportation costs in this way to support the room and board issue. I'll try to answer any questions, and the tough ones I will defer to or send one quick staff to appear with additional comments.
Mr. Chair of the committee, just briefly, my name is Jessica Harris, legislative assistant to Representative Lynn Lundquist, who apologizes he's not able to be here with you today. In short, this bill came to us very recently. It fixes a very small and very specific problem to a very important school district that has a problem being viable without this legislation, and they ask for your consideration. This would be in addition to and not in lieu of any other amendments that you may adopt today, so we aren't expecting this to be all of 2670. If you choose to adopt other amendments, we would consider these in conjunction with.
I didn't know last thing you said.
If you should choose to add character education into 2670, we would be happy to run these amendments in conjunction with that legislation and not in lieu of.
And Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, we think that there should be no fiscal impact if these are transportation dollars that would have been paid if these kids were on buses and instead they're simply living in dormitories, so the cost should have been calculated into the cost of running the school that should get in.
Alrighty, let's do a minute.
Yes. Thank you. Was this legislation in another bill anywhere, or is this just something that's arisen recently?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Max, the issue was one that we were aware of earlier. The vehicle, we were just sort of looking for the right vehicle for this that we could use to put this bill or this amendment into, and the bill is moving and has the right writing.
Follow up?
Yes, Mr. President.
Is there anybody that opposed to this amendment?
Not that we're aware of, Mr. Chairman, Director Maddox. We've heard no opposition to the bill. It may, in fact, be the only way to keep a high school in this.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. So the question from the committee?
One quick question of the committee administrator. Do we have the fiscal on this one?
Okay, we just received the amendment that's passed today. Thank
you. All righty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your consideration of the time given before us.
Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honored to be on this side of the committee and looking forward to going home early.
Oh, hi, my dear.
Oh, we're getting top tier, man.
I do want to help you. Any help? Here to speak in support of HB 2670, and I'm offering some amendments that I think would be a more appropriate approach to the bill. I've spoken to Representative Starr, and he indicated he was bringing this bill forward. I was delighted, since one of my favorite politicos in the country right now, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, is sort of leading the fight nationally for character education in Maryland. She's Robert Kennedy's daughter, and I think makes a very compelling case when I've heard her talk about the need to start incorporating some of these concepts into our school system. The A4 amendments, if you'll look on page 3, rather than stipulating that one particular curriculum be utilized or encouraged, it directs the Oregon Department of Education to apply for a federal grant that's currently available under the U.S. Department of Education to help states develop curriculum for character education. And this is the sort of approach that I would prefer that we take rather than prejudging one curriculum that's better than another. I think it's also important to sort of put some context in the character education. This is not something new. This is probably something that legislatures every decade or two or three decide we need to talk about. And I have some off the internet some information. In 1929, the Oregon legislature passed a law, ORF 336067, requiring Oregon public schools to instruct in ethics and morality. And there's a number of things, but these are things Representative Mannix, I think, was referring to. 1991, State Board of Education adopted a policy regarding character education in Oregon's public schools, and there are statements that were adopted under rule. I won't read it all. 1993, the State Board of Education adopted an administrative rule which has the force of state law to include character education as an element of a standard education in Oregon's public schools. That's OAR 581-21-200. I'll read that one. Character education is the process of helping students develop and practice the core ethical values that society shares and holds important. These values include, that are not limited to, respect, responsibility, caring, trustworthiness, justice, and fairness, and civic virtue and citizenship. 1994, State Board of Education adopted 36 curriculum content requirements to ensure that all Oregon students have access to a comprehensive program of study. Every school district and state is required to incorporate these content requirements into their instructional program, and character education is part of that. Again, we're not talking about something that's new here. I think what we're doing with this bill is reemphasizing the need to do this. And I think directing the department to go after an existing pot of federal money would be the proper direction. I think the curriculum, the character curriculum is probably as good as any other. I think the state keeps that curriculum available to school districts along with the multitude of other character ed curriculum. There's nothing prevents today the school district from utilizing that curriculum. But I think I would rather see us direct the state to help figure out whether there are other new types of curriculum we should be looking at, and I think a grant from the federal government would help us do that. Every school is different, every district is different, every teacher is different. I think to put in legislation a passing of judgment sanctioning one curriculum over another would really be inappropriate at this time. I would respectfully urge you to adopt the approach I've outlined in the A4s. The bulk of the previous pages are identical. I think I did add the word courageousness on page 2 to the list of moral standards. But I do think it's a good idea. I know some of my colleagues on my side of the aisle will try to make light of this type of legislation, and I really think that this is something that these types of values are something we do need to think about and acknowledge and encourage in our schools and in our homes. And in response to Representative Edwards' question about parents, I think conceivably if the state had money to develop new curriculum, one of the goals we might ask them to do is devise curriculum, character education curriculum that
is more proactive about involving families. I think that if schools had extra money from the federal government to do some of this, it might be helpful in their efforts to get families more involved with the kids and their values and their character. And so I could see that being a part of any projects that are taken by the state, again, with the support of federal money.
Oh, I see that.
Listen by a famous German. Representative Beck, you used to sit right over here, and I guess my question would be that if the committee chose not to adapt the A4s and it did not come out as a unanimous vote or some more than one voting no, is this what we would expect a minority report to look like?
I would probably ask my colleagues to do a minority report, and I think given the, in all seriousness, but given the number of bills with these mandates that have on the floor, even though I realize the bill is not an absolute mandate, it certainly appears like we're favoring one specific curriculum, which I think is totally inappropriate. But I think it would be a worthy debate to have on the floor to talk about directing the state to go get some money to help us develop curriculum rather than favoring one curriculum, existing curriculum, over all others. I would ask a couple people to vote no and do a minority report. Yeah, you bet. Why not?
You're looking this way.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Reverend Beck, welcome back. It seems to me we can accommodate both of these. It seems to me that if you take a look at your A4s and the A2s, other than the fact that we have different words at different points to describe the same virtues, that we could take from page 3 of the A4 amendments, lines 6 to 11, saying, by the way, there is a mandate there. We're mandating that the Department of Education apply for a grant, and that the money shall be used in the manner consistent with the federal grant program. You could also adopt Section 4, which is lines 19 through 21, which I think is a smart idea, which is an emergency clause. And you could still continue with the A2 amendments, which just encourages, doesn't mandate, the use of the character counts, but also encourages the alternative of a similar program on character development. You took those two, you put them together, and you've got the grant application. You have the potential to implement the grant. You also have the character counts as an encouraged program or a similar program. Doesn't that seem like a nice compromise?
Sure. I just object to the principle, Mr. Chair. I object to the principle of favoring one curriculum that's out there. I mean, are we going to start placing in statute, directing school districts to read, the Palmer and Colton World History book text? Because I studied Palmer and Colton in college, and that was the way to learn their world history, and there's no better way, my gosh. And so that's the way kids should learn. I think this has that same. I think we're circling down the path of favoring one curriculum over another. I think that's inappropriate. I really do. And I think a compromise certainly could be achieved here, but I don't know how I feel about the bill at that point.
Sure. Aren't we talking then more about style? Because even in your version, you're saying we encourage that you have a program and you describe the program. Here we give an example of a program and then say something similar. So we end up, it seems to me, six of one and a half dozen of the other. I agree with your point. We shouldn't be specifying and say this must be so, but a similar program on character development, both of you say it should be secular in nature.
Mm-hmm. The permissive nature of the Dash 2s is, better than requiring it. It's up to you, and maybe some other people here to testify have other thoughts. Some of the
holistic beneficial compromise.
I appreciate your efforts. All the speaks into the ground, Representative Manning. But how I feel. I don't think it's necessary to outline a specific curriculum. I think the record's very clear. The department, maybe if you want a list, if the department has a list of existing curriculum that they have on file that they provide to schools, if you want to just list all the curriculum that are currently available And just, you know, might be fair to every little corporate group out there. What curriculums? I'm sure there are probably a dozen or more of them. Maybe we just want to list them all on the bill.
At least we've had a pilot program right here in the state. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, in the spirit of bipartisan cooperation, I too had a similar idea of melding the two together. It doesn't seem like they're that far, and if you somehow make a reference to the character's first series, you know, it seems to me without, I understand your point, I'm not sure even reading this bill it says that other than, you know, that's one and or a similar program, but we could wordsmith that. I think trying to get the two together makes some sense. I think bringing the idea that the department should go out and try to find some money and help districts is also important. So who are we not to ask them to go find money? So.
Great. Any other questions, Representative Beck?
Thank you, Representative Beck. Very much.
I thank you for bringing this forward.
You got it. Is anyone else that wishes to testify on any of the amendments to House Bill 2670? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2670.
Are we in work session?
We could be. We opened this. I had a nod from my colleagues that they would be supportive of maybe melding these two bills together in the form that our cinematic suggested.
Mr. Chairman, I would also want to know if there's any consensus on the third amendment to work colleagues for.
For sure. I'm fine with that.
However, there should be a fiscal on that before we...
Actually,
Mr. Chairman,
let's see a minute. Let's go ahead and open work session. Work session, House Bill 2670.
Maybe rolling there. First, I'll move the A2 amendment as modified by adding to the bill from the A4 amendments lines 6 through 11 and lines 19 through 21.
Very good. We have a motion on the floor, sir. Please repeat it, Rebecca.
The A2 amendments, as modified by adding to the bill and to the amendments, page 3 of the H4 amendments is effectively lines 6 through 11 and lines 19 through 21. These would be additions to the bill.
Did you not say you wanted to
see lines 19 through 21?
Okay. Thank you.
Discussion on the amendments. You want to address the fiscal?
No, there's no fiscal on this one. I think it's on the A3 that we're
going to bring.
That's right. Is there any discussion, questions regarding the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion?
Just a point, not an opposition. I just want to make clear, I think we stated earlier that the intent of amending the amendment is not to encourage any one program over another, but that we're recognizing, even though it's kind of worded perhaps that way, is that we're suggesting this is one of any other program either department comes up with through their getting money, hopefully, but that this is just an example. Is that,
in fact, if you like, I can amend it further to increase your comfort level, depending on whether or not we have unanimous consent for a conceptual amendment. If you'd like, I could even amend this further, but it'd be conceptual because I'd be giving you the words rather than just choosing people. I can do that real fast.
I'm comfortable with what we have here.
All right. As long as the intent's understood, and I believe it is. Right?
Very good. See no opposition to the amendments as proposed or amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chairman,
A2.
A2 as modified by the court as an A4.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the A3 amendments.
I have a motion to adopt the A3 amendments. Discussion on the motion.
Yes. As I understand the testimony from the good senator, A3s actually have no fiscal impact because they're simply being allowed to use, instead of paying to run the bus back and forth, they get to convert that gasoline into room and board.
Devin.
I understand the concept that they're advancing, and I think there might be some merit to the concept they're advancing, but I'm not sure that's entirely the case, that there would be no fiscal impact, because what you would be doing...
Yes, that's clarified.
Okay, I'll take it back then.
It was just pointed out that on lines 9 through 11, it does say, in lieu of the transportation, and reasonable room and board can be provided at equal or less expense than the transport.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I still would like to see the potential of a fiscal on it before it comes to the floor. I find it in my committee that there should be a fiscal before it comes up to the floor, because I don't know if the drafters of it Representative Lundquist's assistant here on this hand is in great detail, but the state law reads that we currently will pay 70% of allowable transportation costs.
Representative Devlin, this is informed by our staff that before we drop the bill, we have to get a fiscal anyway, so those would go to the floor together, so that we'd have, if there was a fiscal here, we'd have that information on the floor when the bill is there.
Okay.
Is that okay, Representative?
That will resolve my issue, actually.
Representative Meyer?
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out this is a House bill, so if there is a fiscal, if they go to the Senate, it can then go to Ways and Means.
And I'd like to move this thing forward as quickly as possible just because it is a House bill, and I can see there are no other discussions. Any other discussion on the A3 amendment? Do we have opposition to adopting the A3 amendment? Seeing no opposition, we'll adopt the A3 amendment to House Bill 2670.
Mr. Chairman,
amendment.
I move the bill to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Congress, you have a motion on the floor to move the bill to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any questions? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Byrne.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Representative Yeh.
Aye.
Excuse. We'll close the work session in the House of 670. Thank you very much, colleagues, for that. We'll
look at the agenda, see where we go next. Or we'll call Mark in here. Do you want to do the bus or the rest number?
Oh, they're all in the other end of their shop. Yeah, but I don't. They kept me out of there because I was saying that.
Oh, would you like to move next, Mr. Chair?
Whatever.
I don't have any authorization to move anymore.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Oh.
So we are at ease.
Hello, Mr.
Chair.
Hold it.
We moved the buses.
Okay, for the audience's information, we will be skipping SDR 7 today, and Senate Bill 194 and Senate Bill 1061 amendments are coming for 1061, and I apologize for not putting this out there sooner today. 194 also, yeah. And we will go now to we're going out to Senate Bill 238 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 238. Overview, if you would, where we left this bill. We at least didn't have a post up on that before and didn't get to it, so.
Mr. Chairman, right now the
Boxing and Wrestling Commission is under the effective control of the superintendent of state police. And they were concerned about management problems and conducted a management review. And as a result of that review, they're proposing this legislation that transfers certain duties and functions of the superintendent to the Oregon State Boxing Commission itself. The superintendent still has some responsibility, and there may or may not be amendments offered to this bill.
All righty. Bob Miller. Jay Isaacson. Jay, come on up, will you? Didn't see you back there. Mr. Miller, please introduce yourself to the record and get right into it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Miller. I'm the director of the Oregon State Police Gaming Enforcement Division, and the Boxing Wrestling Commission comes under my supervision within the agency. I'm here today to ask your support of Senate Bill 238, and I'd like to begin my testimony with a very brief history and overview of the Boxing Wrestling Commission. Oregon Boxing Wrestling Commission was created by this body in 1987 to address some concerns within both boxing and wrestling as far as the state of the industry. Those were concerning medical standards, fairness, fraud, and environmental safety at the events. In 1993, the legislature moved the Boxing and Wrestling Commission from the governor to the Department of State Police. In the latter part of 1996, the superintendent was made aware by some of the commissioners that there seemed to be some problems within the commission. Based on those concerns, the superintendent directed that a management audit be conducted at the commission. And what that review revealed was that there was a reversal of roles between the director and the individual commissioners, that in fact, over a period of time, that the commission evolved into a body of five commissioners who had little input into the decisions affecting boxing wrestling in Oregon, and that the director had assumed a role similar to a CEO and made nearly all decisions with inadequate input from the commission. In February 1970, the department implemented an action plan to address those issues. I've listed nine things the department did to address those, everything from realigning the organizational placement of the commission within the agency, delegation of what duties or responsibilities superintendent could under current law, amended the position description of the directors, provided formal training, and directed the commission meetings be held on a regular basis and at a minimum of quarterly. All those points of the action plan have been implemented, and I'm happy to report that you have a viable commission that I believe is doing a very good job of regulated boxing and wrestling within the state. However, there is one action final step that hasn't been implemented, and that's because it requires action by this body, and that recommendation was to review and modify authority of the commission and superintendent. Was contained in statute for revision for next legislative session. Current statutes do not allow appropriate level of authority and autonomy for the commission and foster the reversal of roles as determined in our review of the commission's effectiveness. Senate Bill 238 is proposed to accomplish this last goal. It will statutorily shift the authority to regulate from the superintendent to the commission. Superintendent will continue to have appointment and removal authority of the commission and the executive director. He also has budgetary responsibility and accountability in addition to the general oversight of the commission's activities. core pieces of this proposal are contained in Section 4, Subsection 2, and this is the section of law that currently confers upon the superintendent the following powers. Those are the powers to enforce boxing and wrestling rules, the power to license and regulate those involved in the industry, the responsibility to maintain records of events, and the responsibility to report results of contests. Once these powers and responsibilities are shifted to the commission, the majority of the remaining changes within the current statute become technical housekeeping. At this time, Mr. Chair, I can walk the committee through the changes. There are a number of them. I know time's short. I guess I need another
week. Hold off on that for now and maintain that as an option here as we proceed. Any questions from the committee at this point?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to continue. There are some amendments that have been added to the original bill, if I can just comment briefly on those.
Okay.
Subsequent to the introduction of Senate Bill 238, Sections 11 and 12 were added by amendment. The express purpose of this addition to the original bill was to attract the World Wrestling Federation, the World Championship Wrestling, to Oregon. I need to point out that there is nothing in current Oregon law that prohibits or restricts either of these organizations from coming to Oregon right now. Oregon has a healthy professional wrestling industry. Since July 1 of 1997, there have been 50 professional wrestling shows within the state. The vast majority of these events were promoted by Kafori Wrestling Promotions. All 50 shows were sanctioned by the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Oregon also has a clean professional wrestling industry. On February 14, 1999, NBC's Dateline ran a show entitled Wrestling Violence. On March 30th of 1999, ESPN's Outside the Lines ran an hour-long special entitled Pro Wrestling Hold on America. These reports portrayed an industry which promotes inappropriate violence and sexual behavior, illegal drug use and abuse, and premature deaths of wrestlers. The syndicated news show Inside Edition commissioned an Indiana University study of 50 WWF Raw episodes, which appeared on the USA Network in 1998. A reporter for the show said he became interested in studying wrestling when his wife, a middle school teacher, told him about her students imitating the behavior seen on the shows. You've got a copy of my testimony. I'm not going to refer to the first researcher observation, but as you go through there, the other ones, the researchers found 157 instances of wrestlers or audience members making obscene gestures 434 times when people either said a sexually charged slogan or displayed one on a sign, 128 episodes of simulated sexual activity, 47 references to satanic activity, one segment featured people supposedly drinking blood from a dead wrestler, draining blood from a dead wrestler and drinking it, and there were 609 instances of wrestlers or others being struck with objects such as garbage cans or nightsticks. My point in relaying this to the committee is this, that the Oregon industry does not suffer from the same problems as are represented in these national news programs. This is true for several reasons. The Oregon legislature created the Boxing and Wrestling Commission in 1987 and charged it with regulating safe and untarnished professional wrestling within the state, and they've done that. The Boxing and Wrestling Commission developed and enforced rules to meet that legislative mandate, and the Oregon professional wrestling industry has complied with those rules and has been responsible and cooperative partners with the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Both the state police and the Boxing and Wrestling Commission are uncomfortable with Section 12 of the A. and Gross bill. However, As it is currently worded and written, it has a very narrow and limited impact, and therefore we do not oppose its inclusion within the bill. And that, Mr. Chair, does conclude my prepared testimony.
Mr. Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. And the question I have is, you mentioned that there's nothing in Oregon that prevents the pursuing groups in coming to Oregon now, correct?
That is correct. That's the chair, Representative Starr.
So why do we need the bill in order to get them to come?
It would be, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, it would be my position that you don't need the bill. Section 12 is a compromise. We've worked hard with the sponsors of that amendment. It's an amendment that we can live with if the policy statement of this body is good for the industry. I'm a little perplexed since if you notice the dates on these various reports, it came out, especially the ESPN report came out after our debate and work on the Senate side. I'm a little confused because Vince McMahon, the owner of one of these national organizations, said on national television that he would love to come to Oregon, and then in fact that they participate in states now that have drug testing, and that doesn't present a problem to them. And so we are getting some mixed signals from the national industry.
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, just a short question. Most of the testimony that we're receiving, both in this committee and outside of this committee, in terms of people contacting us, is all relative to professional wrestling, whether it's being promoted inside the space or some group coming in. But isn't the reality relative to professional boxing? And I know that there are people that believe that whether it should be permitted or not. But the reality is, when we put in place the Boxing Commission and the way it's operated in previous years, for all practical purposes, we've had no professional boxing in the state of Oregon. There's a few minutes, and that's about it. Isn't that the case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, that is correct. Last time the legislature was in session, there had been zero boxing matches. There had been two professional wrestling matches within the state. This legislative session, and I believe in large part because a number of the steps that were taken within the state police, working with the current commission, working with the industry, you've gone from zero boxing to we will have our fourth professional show in Oregon this Friday night at the Salem Armory. These are high class, very professional individuals, organizations coming to Oregon. Well, that's been turned around. It takes a lot to put on a wrestling or a boxing show. It takes a couple of months for these guys to put them together, so you're not going to have one every Friday night. We went from two wrestling matches in the last biennium to 50 so far this biennium. When you look at the surrounding states, we're on a par with California. In fact, we're having a few more shows than California is, and we're way ahead of Nevada, Idaho, and Washington as far as professional wrestling.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How is your commission funded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, it's funded mainly through the pay-per-view tax, which is the largest share, and so when Mike Tyson fights somebody's ear off on pay-per-view channel, we get 6% of that.
Because the air there.
We get 6% of live gate receipts. So when the Kaforis put on a wrestling show in Milwaukee, then they save 6% of the live gate receipt. And then the individual licensing and promoter fees is the third funding source.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Barr.
I've been informed that recently a federal judge overthrew the district court throughout California case use act based on the 1st and 14th Amendments of the Constitution. If someone's bringing challenge in Oregon, how are you going to fund your commission then? Assuming they would win in ground.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the current funding scheme for the Boxing Wrestling Commission was developed here in the legislative session. I would suspect that the cure, if this is, and we're looking at this through, obviously, council and observing closely what's occurring in both Oklahoma and California right now, is that this body, that if that manifests itself and threatens the funding stream for the commission, that problem will be brought back to this body.
Further question? Just in a minute.
I noticed that we put in the dash, or the A and growth version of the bill, with page 9, line 41, in reference to the physical exam that dated not earlier than 12 months prior to the scheduled date. And in some of the written testimony, there's indication about, well, these records are already set there, examined from, on an annual basis. My concern would be whether or not that is an up-to-date enough exam to cover the concerns addressed by the conditions to be examined. Do you have any discussion about whether or not 12 months is too long?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, the language that is in here now is consistent with, and actually much of this language came out of the current OAR, and so this language is consistent with our current language within, it's consistent with current rule. There's less of a concern on the wrestling side than there is on the boxing side. All boxers receive a pre-fight physical, and so many of these things were a larger concern with the boxers. On the wrestling side, they're required to provide this within 5 days of the event.
Well, they have to provide the documentation.
Yes.
But the exam could have been a year earlier.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative, there hasn't been a lot of discussion on that. There's some responsibility falls back to the individual, the promoters, and the commission has, their representative has, within current rule, the ability to prevent a match from occurring if, for a number of reasons, if one of the participants showed up and appeared physically unable to participate, appeared to be under the influence of either alcohol or drugs. And so I think that safety mechanism is probably built into current rules. So this is one of the issues that causes me a little bit of concern, because up in the Section 2, Line 9, 10, 11, those all deal with the licensing provisions, and so it's unclear to me if some of those collateral provisions of, right now, the real enforceability that you have on those other rules to participants is the possibility that they could lose, they could either be suspended or their license could be revoked. The way this is currently written, those individuals aren't licensed, and so I don't know what sort of hook or hammer you have over these individuals coming into the state.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Why couldn't we require that the exam had been within the previous 3 months or a little more contemporaneous? So someone can actually go in and get an exam 4 times a year if they're engaged in this kind of activity.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, you certainly could.
Representative Gardner?
Yeah, part of the big difference between wrestling and boxing, that wrestling is mostly choreographed, stage, and theater.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, that's the correct statement, it is.
So, if I make it to you, we don't in this state, you know, have all sorts of testing, quarterly or otherwise, for other forms of theater groups, rock bands, or anything of that nature, do we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I'm not sure. I'm not real familiar with what we do. There is a distinction, if I might, between choreographed wrestling events. Some would refer to it as theater, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, other than when you go to traditional theater, the violence you watch, the blood you see spilled, the body fluids you see airborne passes in sorts of things is all make-believe. These are real 250, 300-pound men that are being thrown around the ring. It's real violence. It's real blood. And so your potential for HIV, hepatitis, some of these other communicable disease, health issues are very real. It's not fake blood. It's not fake violence. That's why there is such a high incidence of abuse of painkillers and other barbiturate narcotic type of drugs within the wrestling industry, because, I mean, you can look at these guys. These guys spend a lot of time in the gym. These guys pump themselves up. Those who abuse steroids for a very real reason is because it is theater, but it's also part sport as well. These guys are performers.
I think that's what I'm wrestling with, no pun intended. It's this idea of, is it sport or is it entertainment? And I guess I tend to fall in, this is complete entertainment. I mean, I think it's evolved away from any sort of sport, at least as I've periodically seen it on TV, which I guess to me raises the question of all this testing. I mean, I guess I follow up on Representative Gardner's comment or question. You know, when a circus comes to town and you have acrobats, there's a certain amount of risk involved there. Obviously, if somebody was on a high wire and had some sort of health problem, I mean, they're taking a risk. I guess I'm trying to balance that type of a risk, which I kind of fall these people in that category versus a complete sport activity where it's not staged in any way. I mean, at least hopefully it's not. I mean, you always hear the movies about boxers and things being a fight being thrown. But that aside, I'm saying typically it's two people or more engaged in something that has an uncertain outcome. These are all tricks, at least as I've seen it. So I guess I tend to fall in the entertainment camp. I don't see the argument that this is sport and hence you need to have all these regulations. I guess I'm troubled by that.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, and I readily admit that a couple of years ago I was in the same position, and having been in this job and having had to wrestle with this whole deregulation of the wrestling industry, I probably entered the job thinking, well, why are we messing around with this stuff? It's fake, it's all this kind of thing. Well, I actually have found a definition that seems to kind of fit, and it came from a November 2nd, 1997 article by Dwight James of the Oregonian in Portland. And he defines it as, he says it's part theater, part sport, and part old-time carnival con game. And that seems to kind of be the essence of it. And I, you know, much to my wife's chagrin, I watch this stuff on television a little bit. You know, it's kind of fun. Why does it need to be regulated? I have come to the decision in this job and what I've seen that the industry does need to be regulated. I've talked to a number of professional wrestlers within Oregon. They've all told me to a man that the industry should be regulated. You've got a promoter in the audience, I believe, is going to talk to you. My understanding, he believes the industry should be regulated. It should be regulated not so much for what it is today, but what it could become if you don't regulate it. I've been a state policeman for 22 years. I spent most of my time in our criminal investigations division. I've seen more dead bodies and mayhem and stuff than I ever would have wanted to see in my life. I've got a videotape in my office that almost literally made me sick to my stomach when I saw a 17-year-old kid just beat to a pulp these knives that have razor blades that they use to cut carpet and tiles and stuff. A, quote, professional wrestler took that 17-year-old kid down that they just beat with a metal chair and cut his head open to where blood was squirting out on the ground.
That almost literally, that turned my stomach, and that is what you can get in this state if you don't regulate the industry to some degree. That was done in the spirit of professional wrestling. And that 17-year-old kid with his dad screaming in the background, you know, crying for mercy and saying he's a minor, that has brought me, that is one of the factors that brought me to the point that this industry does need to be regulated. There's no reason to change that, I don't believe, when you're having 50 shows in the state since July 1 of 1997. And why would we, as a state, want to go there?
And then you do a follow up.
Well, two things. I mean, how is that germane, your comment, to asking for a health exam? I mean, if somebody's attacking somebody, that's a different aspect than asking if somebody's health. If I'm not following your logic there.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards. I thought you had taken the discussion beyond that point and was asking me why. If it's theater, if it's a show, why should it be regulated? I apologize if I misunderstood the question.
And I do think there's one thing that, I mean, of late that's happened since this bill moved was the death of a wrestler not long ago. And part of that was he did an act, and I don't, to me, that's a safety issue, and I don't know how, to me, that's not a health-related issue. That was the act itself. Does this bill somehow help in some way provide some safety in that sense, in that type of regulated environment? Not the health of the rest of them, I'm talking about. Will the commission have the ability to sort of see what the general program is going to be in and make sure there's some safety requirements?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I believe that our current rules, which deal with unsafe acts would cover that. Wrestling is not the only dangerous injury, and you're going to have industrial accidents occur sometime, and I'm not sure that anybody really knows exactly what happened there. It appears that he may have hit his quick release. That would be when the show comes in, because it is pre-scripted, pre-choreographed in some sense. We've got some idea of what stunts are going to be told, you know, some of these kind of things. And of course, the venue, in this case, the Rose Garden, certainly have an interest in all those matters as well from liability standpoint. So I think we're covered under current rules.
Now it's me, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, what we're basically doing, besides making some technical adjustments, which is what most of this bill is about, is we're allowing the touring groups to come into Oregon and exempting them from the annual licensing requirement and putting in this substitute provision in regard to medical exams. The reason I got into that a bit is that when you're licensing someone, you do have, A, the threat of taking away their license and suspending it, which means they can't perform in this area anymore. And B, you are having some sort of continuing control over the individual. When you would exempt those who come in, you have less of that control. You still have to, I suppose, permit the event to occur, so you have control over the promoter. And the participants have to follow the rules that the commission set. I just wondered about the 12-month provision, wondering if that was contemporaneous enough, if someone's been examined a year before. I realize the first parallel is the one-year licensing because the community of probably having hands done with that. But I was just wondering where the 12 months came from.
Mr. Chair, Representing Manning, I'm really not sure where it comes from.
Okay. Current language is where we are. So the decision that was made that led to that, do you have any background on
that? Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you support the bill for high relief is in this section of 12? The section 12 is amendment that was made in the Senate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representing Starr, that is correct. Senate Bill 238, as it stands, excluding sections 11 and 12, is the bill that we presented on the Senate side.
And it's your testimony that the steering groups can come to argue on their current statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stark, the WWF, WCW can come to Oregon today under current rules.
Further questions? Mr. Isaac.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am J.E. Isaac, Senior Vice President of the Oregon Arena Corporation, appearing in support of Senate Bill 238. The Oregon Arena Corporation operates the Rose Quarter, a public-private joint venture with the City of Portland. The Rose Quarter generates substantial income tax revenues for the state, property tax revenue for Multnomah County, and user fee and parking revenues for the City of Portland. Among our objectives in operating this venue is to provide Oregonians with a diverse range of entertainment opportunities. We became involved in Senate Bill 238 to create a regulatory structure that will allow national professional wrestling touring groups, which are seen regularly on both cable and pay-per-view television in Oregon, to return to Oregon in a live form. Unlike boxing or NBA basketball, professional wrestling isn't really a sport in which contestants compete to win. Professional wrestlers are entertainers with scripted and choreographed acts. We don't regulate entertainers who perform in circuses, theatrical plays, or concerts. With the approval of the Chairman of the Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee, we worked with the Oregon State Police to draft regulations that are consistent with the mission of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission, yet would remove obstacles that prevent these touring groups from coming here. The most significant obstacle was a physical examination required near the time a professional wrestling troupe would appear in Oregon. Professional wrestling organizations such as the WWF and WCW conduct annual physical exams for their wrestlers, but they find it too expensive to do separate exams to satisfy an individual state's requirements. The solution we worked out with the OSP is to create a regulatory category for professional wrestling that recognizes its entertainment rather than sports nature. We did not ask for deregulation of professional wrestling. SB 238 maintains regulation by the Commission to ensure public safety at professional wrestling events. The Commission also will ensure that wrestlers are physically fit to perform the falls and stunts that are part of the act. We have been given assurances by the WCW and the WWF that these changes will lead to the return of professional wrestling in Oregon. I readily acknowledge that professional wrestling isn't everyone's cup of tea. People either really like or dislike it. The provisions in SB 238 deal with regulation of professional wrestling for public safety and the well-being of its participants without discriminating against this particular type of entertainment. The issue here isn't about drug use. The physical exams required under SB 238's professional wrestling regulation require that a licensed physician certify that the wrestler has no alcohol or drug addiction or evidence of drug usage based on a physical examination and medical history. No laws regarding illicit drug possession or use are modified or compromised. The Oregon Arena Corporation and the Trailblazers have a long-standing record of involvement in and commitment to anti-drug and youth drug education initiatives. We do not feel in any way that our support for Senate Bill 238 is in any way a conflict with our anti-drug corporate position. We urge your support for Senate Bill 238. And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think I can be responsive to some of the questions that were posed earlier, if I can depart from my prepared statement at this time.
Please do, Mr. Rogers.
One of the first questions that was asked, I believe by Representative Mannix, was the question about the annual examination versus perhaps one every 3 months. And then I believe another representative asked, you know, where did the 12 months that's in the current language come from? That was based on the annual physical examinations that are already done by the WCW and the WWF, which are sufficient for the majority of states in the United States. So
the WWF and the WCW rely on that annual physical and are able to go into the majority of the states in the union with that annual physical, and but rather than do a separate one for the state of Oregon, which is now, I believe, by the current wording, required 30 days prior to a match. Becomes too expensive for them on a cost-justified basis. Second, I'd like to talk about the question of the status of the professional wrestling industry in the state of Oregon. Captain Miller is correct that here lately there have been additional shows in the state of Oregon, wrestling shows. However, what we're talking about here in terms of attendance is much greater. These types of shows around the country sell out not only arenas but stadiums. Tens of thousands of people want to come to these shows. And if you look at the ratings here in Oregon, whether you like the content of the shows or not, you have to acknowledge that there are people in the state of Oregon who really enjoy this kind of entertainment and would like to be able to see it live.
Sure.
Well, basically, what we're doing here then is simply opening the door to the tour groups, still providing for the same kind of exam we require for our local licentiates. And your point is that the 12-month parallels with other states, too. It seems to me it's important to emphasize the language of page 9 of the bill, because you have limited the type of wrestling that this applies to, and that's lines 5 through 8. That provides entertainment by staging choreographed wrestling matches, contests, or exhibitions in which there is no intent to punish, immobilize, or throw a wrestler with the possible effect of rendering the wrestler incapable of continuing the wrestling match, contest, or exhibition. So this is limiting language as to the kinds of events or shows that we're talking about, and if they don't meet this limiting prescriptive language, then the rest of this doesn't matter anyway. Is that fair to say?
Representative Manager, I think that's exactly right. We tried to draft language here that would only exempt theatrical shows of this nature, not true competitive events where one wrestler is entering the ring against an unknown opponent. These are traveling troops who are a closed system that have their own regulations. They have their own, in the NBA, we have an owners group that decides what the rules are, and in the WWF, they have rules and regulations. WWF has spot drug testing, that sort of thing.
Can I follow up?
Yeah.
To me, the parallel then would be stuntmen or stunt doubles from Hollywood. I mean, they're involved in entertainment, but they're actually carefully choreographed. They obviously don't want to get hurt, and they're working together, even though you may see them engaged in a fist fight. They've worked it out very carefully so that neither one of them. The plan is not to injure, not to maim, not to defeat, but to entertain.
Representative Max, that's exactly the point, because these people have to get up and go to the next city the next day and do it all over again.
Year after work. No, not too many years. I don't have
it. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Representative Edwards?
I think you may have stated, what's the potential revenue for... We anticipate that the gross economic impact would approach $7.5 million per year. Taxation, I haven't figured that out, but the city of Portland gets a 6% user fee on all gross gates plus parking revenues, so the city of Portland would stand to, to make additional revenues as well.
Okay. Any more questions from the committee? Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming forward. We also have Ivan Kafori.
Gentlemen, my name is Ivan Kafori. I'm an owner and promoter for Portland Wrestling. I've been in business for 2 years as a wrestling promoter.
and I'm the only Russian promoter license in the state of Oregon, have been for that period of time. I am totally in support of the WWF, WCW coming to Oregon. All I'm asking is that for the, you know, I get the same treatment. So I'm saying that on this Senate Bill 238, I'm recommending an amendment on page 9 of the printed A and Gross Bill, line 3, delete the term incorporated or organized other under a law other than an Oregon law. All I'm saying is if they come and they get, you know, special treatment, I should get special treatment because I am an Oregon corporation and employ Oregon wrestlers. Now, you might ask, why do I want this? Very simply, a lot of times I recruit wrestlers that have been in the WWF or WCW, no longer run under their banner, and I can recruit them as independents to wrestle for me. I think they should be subjected to the same tests that the current WCW and or WWF and WCW wrestlers would have under this new bill. That's all I have. Any questions?
Any questions from Mr. Ford? President Edwards.
Did you raise this issue on the Senate side?
Pardon me?
Did you raise this?
No, I did not. It got through the Senate before I knew about it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, now what is your...
Well, what I'm going to do is close the public hearing and open the work session on Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd move Senate Bill 238 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman. I would hope President Gardner would want to add the amendment that he had distributed to us.
No, I'm without the movement of that. I was given the nature and talking to the state police, they seem to be very much opposed to that and upset the delicate balance in the bill. And I guess I was intending to move the bill without the amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
We have a bill motion before us, and now Richard Mannix, yes?
I move that we amend the motion by adding the A6 amendment.
And,
Okay, explain. Okay.
Yes, please.
Well, actually, the A6 amendment refers simply to this narrow class of entertainment, as opposed to boxing matches, wrestling matches, true competitions. You're still going to need to be licensed. You're going to have to follow all the rules. But if you've got this very narrow class of entertainment, then why can't an Oregon promoter do the entertainment just as much as a California promoter? In that sense, I disagree with the concerns that may have been expressed, and I'm willing to do it. But, of course, it's up to the committee. But I'm willing to say an Oregon entertainment promoter is just as good as a California entertainment promoter. The licensing requirement will still apply to any regular boxing or wrestling, the way the public would understand them, at least, in terms of fisticuffs and old-fashioned wrestling.
Okay. Star.
And I would move to amend the amended motion to strike section 11 and 12 from the bill. As testimony from the state police indicated, they're not strongly in favor of that poor part of this bill. In fact, it's my understanding is that we don't need that part of this bill in order to have these folks come to this state. I'm certainly not going to change the laws to encourage them to come. They can come under the current structure of our ORS statute.
Mr. Chairman,
this is an A6 amendment.
Yes, no. President May.
I understand President Starr's motion, and it seems to me more appropriate to first deal with whether or not we're going to add an A6, because that is inconsistent with Representative Starr's motion. Then you can separately deal with Representative Starr's motion. If I may respectfully suggest his motion's out of order until we deal with the A6.
Well, I would concur. I think we had a motion to move the bill forward as is, and plus we've had a motion to amend that motion to add the A6 amendments to the bill. We did hear some comments earlier about the state police's position on the A6 amendments. I would just ask Mr. Miller to come back up to the witness stand, if you would, and are you aware of the A6 amendment?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Bob Miller, State Police.
I am aware of the amendment. I'm not sure I've seen it.
Are you aware of the impact of the A6 amendment, the intended impact?
I've had a long conversation with Mr. Kafori. I understand and respect his position and believe it's a correct position for him to take. Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, of those 50 professional wrestling matches that occurred within the state since July 1 of 1997, all of those would meet the definition that appears in the language now. And so you would, in effect, all wrestling that occurs within Oregon from passage of this bill forward would be exempted from licensing requirements. Now, one of the concerns that raises with the commission and the state police is that there's too many unknown ramifications of this current language. In other words, there's a different business relationship, my understanding, between those in the WCW and WWF as currently exist between Oregon wrestlers and Mr. Kafori. Oregon wrestlers could more accurately be likened to independent contractors. And so, again, the problem in not having the ability to sanction wrestlers for prohibited conduct through either revocation or suspension or denial of licensing provisions would no longer be there.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Manny.
I respectfully suggest that I know you didn't have a chance to look at that amendment until now. Reading the bill the way it is, I'll just tell Mr. Kafori, just go out there and find a friend in California to organize a corporation, and under Section 12 of this bill, you can be a partner with someone from out of state, and they can come in and they can tour 365 days a year, as long as they're incorporated or organized under a law other than Oregon law. So if we have a problem with enforcement, it's not that phrase. The problem with enforcement would have to do whatever other rules the state police would want to implement. And so to me, I'd say you define touring group to mean you're not in the state more than 21 days a year or 15 days a year, so you don't have a permanent touring group. Shakespearean plays were produced by touring groups, constantly moving around in England. I mean, that's just the perspective, and I understand the concern, but it seems to me the way to do that is to define how long someone can be in the state and call themselves a touring group, not define who the parent corporation is, because any lawyer, including this one, knows how to get around that one in 30 seconds. That's my comment.
Mr. Chair, if I could make just a few comments,
please.
It's not the position of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission. We've discussed this at length. It's not the position of the Oregon State Police that we want to in any way prohibit or even stand in the way of the WCW or the WWF coming to the state. In fact, from a commission standpoint, that's a desirable thing. Number one, it's correct when Mr. Isaac says that these people bring in big crowds. And as I explained, the revenue stream for the commission will receive a percentage of the live gate receipts on those events. This isn't an anti-WCW, it isn't an anti-WWF sort of stance by either the commission or the state police. We would like nothing better. In fact, it would take some of the detractors off the back of the commission if those entities would in fact come to Oregon. We certainly encourage them to and hope that they do.
Three questions from the committee for Mr. Miller at this point.
Yes, sir.
Yes, one at a time. Mr. McGovern.
Yes. With the amendment that's being offered, the Dash 3.
Dash 3?
Or Dash 6, I'm sorry. Yeah, Dash 6. I'm reading the language here. It talks about such as World Championship Wrestling or the World Wrestling Federation is designated by the Oregon State Boxing and Wrestling Commission. It appears here that even if you pass this amendment, I don't know what Mr. Mannix was reading as it would be. Mr. Kafori says organization would have to go through some review. and would be designated, could be designated as such. Obviously, there might be some grounds for, if they didn't give them the designation and they met all the requirements, towards contesting that. But it doesn't appear that it would be automatic. That they would be. And I agree with Representative Mannix. You don't even have to go as far as California. Just go across to Vancouver and find somebody that'll file, you know, and kind of incorporated the corporation in the state of Washington.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I can tell you what the position of the commission is, and the position of the commission in my discussions with the commission was to take the intent of what this legislation is, and the intent of this legislation was to pave the way for the WCW and the WWF to come to Oregon. Those are the only two national organizations that have been mentioned here, and as far as the commission is concerned, that's the only two organizations they were going to designate as touring groups. In other words, a regional group such as a California, Washington, New England has one. None of those based on the legislative intent would need a qualification of a touring group. Touring group, at least on the Senate side, was very narrowly focused to national organizations and specifically addressed as the WCW and the WWF, and that was going to, or that is the current position of your Oregon and Boxing Wrestling Commission.
Mr.
Chairman. Mr.
Wouldn't a quick fix here be, I assume that they'd be in and out of the state in 30 days, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that's they'd be out in a matter of kind of in one day and out the next.
Well, then why don't we add it to after the petition to allow for a group that may want to go to every small town in the state or every medium-sized city. Add after or exhibition on line 8 to page 9, the phrase, provided each such tour group does not exceed a total of 30 days within Oregon in any given calendar year. And then you've really got a limited time frame. It's really a tour group and not someone who's permanently in the state calling themselves a tour group during wrestling. Or is this something the chair wants taken to a work group? I would like to see a resolution here.
I would like to find some resolution to this, and recognizing that we are later in the session than we are earlier, I hope. And this is a Senate bill, but I would like to dispose of this. And if we can't do it today, if we could iron something out very quickly, we can get this back up to 1 hour notice either tomorrow or the next day and dispose of it.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your consideration. It just seems to me, Captain Miller, if it's appropriate to put a time frame on it, then it doesn't matter whether they're in state or out of state. They're not fooling around for more than 30 days in a year. And then you know that you're not disfavoring an Oregon organization over an out-of-state organization. Does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I may be just a little thick-headed, but I don't understand how attaching that time frame would address Mr. Kapori's concern. And if it isn't meant to do that, then I think the current language...
That's along with the other amendment that takes out the restriction in Oregon.
Right. It would make the language there the A6 strikes unnecessary.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, then I would submit that Mr. Kapori would still have a problem because he wouldn't qualify for any of these exemptions, and he's currently arguing that he should have a level playing field. Mr. Chair, if I could just real quick for the other issue here that causes the commission a lot of concern, that if this is expanded beyond the WCW, WWF, in other words, if it was the intent of the committee or the pleasure of the committee to have the Dash 6 amendment, what that would do, it would eliminate the current requirement of annual drug testing that Oregon wrestlers currently submit to.
Well,
Mr. Chairman?
You opened a bit of a can of worms there, it sounds like.
Well, I just want to know why it's okay for out-of-staters to come in the state if they're incorporated somewhere else and they can stick around there all year and compete with an Oregon industry, if you want to call it that, and not have to follow the same as Oregon standards.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I wrestle with that same problem, and I had that concern, and I didn't share with the committee, I don't believe, that early on in this process on the Senate side, it concerned me greatly that we were setting up a double standard. In other words, you had an Oregon industry that had to comply with a certain set of rules, and you had somebody, because they had big pockets or deep pockets, bringing to the state for revenue. And so I contacted not Ivan Kafoury. I had occasion to have discussions with Jeff Kafoury, who was also involved in Kafoury Enterprises. At that time, I was told by Jeff that he had no opposition to the different sets of standards. And being armed with that information, in other words, that's wrestling in Oregon is the Kafouris.
Jeff did this limitation, then I'd say it's okay, because if you're an Oregon corporation, you can be here year-round. But if you're an out-of-state group and you want to come in, we'll let you come in for 30 days a year under these special standards, but that's it. How about that?
What I'm going to do here, if my colleagues will be kind enough to withdraw their motion,
I'll withdraw my motion.
We will set this again for tomorrow. It's the day after tomorrow, and with intention of applying some resolutions between now and then, and we will move the bill at that time, I hope, and provide some resolutions.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my motion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gardner. And it's
very interesting.
It's my opinion regarding being able to allow the touring groups to come to Oregon, that when we have a product that's being piped into every living room of the state, we ought to allow it to, it's available to the great majority of living rooms in the state of Oregon. We ought to allow businessmen in Oregon to take advantage of promoting those activities. Yes, that's car.
I find it greatly ironic that just after we passed the bill to encourage character in the state, we want to inculcate our children with good character, values of being hospitable and flexible, and cautious and sensitive with respect and honesty, and kind to other folks that we, on the other hand, are going to soften our rules to allow for a folks to come into this state that the testimony shows are anything but full of that kind of character and the kind of message that this sends to the kids in this state. I think it's unfortunate.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your observation. We will close the work session and go on to Senate Bill 363, open public hearing on Senate Bill 363.
We'll come back and discuss the
We have a number of items of business left before us today, and we've kind of got bogged down here several times. I would like to conclude business here in a reasonable hour, and would you please give us a brief overview of Senate Bill 363? We have three senators to testify, and we'll move along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 363A and Gross came from the Senate on a 28-0 vote. It's at the request of the Department of Education, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and it modifies provisions that, in Oregon that relate to special education and related services to comply with federal law. There's a large amount of federal money involved if Oregon does comply and make their changes to the special education law. The bill does exempt obligations of school districts to provide special education to persons that are incarcerated in adult correction facilities unless they've been identified as having a disability or having an individual education program in their last educational placement. There are also provisions that exempt persons who have a high school diploma from eligibility to receive special education services. There's also clarifications in a number of areas of the bill. One is that school districts are continue to be obligated to provide an appropriate public education if the child has been removed for disciplinary reasons. It clarifies when school districts remain obligated when children are expelled if they have disabilities, and they even if they bring a weapon to school. There, you have at your place the Senate staff measure summary. You also have a fiscal impact statement that does not show the income that will be coming to the state, but it does show some of the expenditures, and those are federal funds. The fiscal impact statement is included in the governor's budget, and so that is incorporated into what they're working on with the Department of Education and the school district budget. Mr. Chair, you also have at your place A7 and A6 amendments. The A6 amendments are to resolve conflicts with Senate Bill 932. And the A7 amendments grandfather in certain students who are incarcerated and certain students that have diplomas that continue to be eligible. And Mr. Chair, you have a witness.
Thank you very much. Kathy Osborne, Brian Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project. For those of you who don't know, the Juvenile Rights Project is a nonprofit public interest law firm that represents juveniles in Multnomah County. We deal with both delinquency and dependency cases. We also do advocacy work all over the state of Oregon for the rights of juveniles. With me today is Brian Baker, who's our educational specialist at Juvenile Rights Project. I dealt with this bill when it was over in the Senate. Brian has also been following this bill, and I'll hand it over to Brian now so he can just let you know what our concerns are.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Brian Baker. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I'd like the committee to know that the Juvenile Rights Project is officially neutral on this bill, but it is a good bill, and it is important that this bill move forward. The Oregon Department of Education has been very open and accessible to various community advocates in having input on the bill, and I would like to recognize that that's been very appreciated. The one concern that the Juvenile Rights Project has about the bill is the provision in Section 1, Subsection 3, about opting out for services for 18 to 21-year-olds who are incarcerated in adult correctional facilities. Our concern is that we believe the Department of Corrections has under-identified young people with disabilities. From a community standpoint, it's our belief that education is very, very important to limiting recidivism, to giving young people who are incarcerated, who will return to the community, the opportunity to find employment, to reintegrate into society and not commit other crimes. With the Amendment 7, which we support, it's our belief that there will be a fairly small number of young people between 18 to 21 who won't receive services. And I want the committee to be clear that this provision under Section 1, Subsection 3 does not exclude young people who had already previously been identified for specialized services or had individual education plans before they landed in an adult correctional facility. They will still receive specialized services. There is a certain level of arbitrariness in this opt-out provision. This was a provision in the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act of 97, that allows states to opt out. The arbitrariness is that for any a large number of different reasons, young people are not identified for special ed. They slip through the cracks. I have some statistics, particularly for young people who have a category of emotionally disturbed, and this is from the 20th Annual Report to Congress on the Implementation of the Individuals with Disabilities Act, that show approximately 58% of those students within 3 to 5 years of finishing their secondary education have been arrested versus 19% with other disabilities. 10% of those folks are living in correctional facilities, halfway houses, drug treatment centers, or are homeless.
48% of the young women with emotional disturbance are mothers, as opposed to single mothers, as opposed to 28% of young people with other disabilities. There are a number of reasons why these young people slip through the cracks. That the report identified is that the process of identifying or failing to identify these kids is often, and I quote, often reactive, subjective, limited by a local lack of culturally and linguistically appropriate assessment tools, driven by institutional needs, constrained by clinical concerns about the ability of labels and inappropriate placement, as well as by the inability of some professionals to collaborate with families or with others. The point that I'll leave the committee with is we will work, the Human Rights Project will work with the Department of Corrections to address the issue of identification or under-identification. It is possible that in the next session in 2001, we would find it necessary to come back to address a continuing issue of under-identification. At this point, we're pleased with the process of tapping it. Taking questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Mr. Byer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens if we don't pass this bill?
The issue, Mr. Sheriff, Representative Byer, the issue at this point is districts, local districts around the state are waiting IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, was amended in 1997. The federal regulations came out in late March of 1999. Right now, the state has a constituency work group that is amending our state administrative rules to bring them in compliance with the new federal regulations, as well as amending Senate Bill 263 is amending our state statutes to be in compliance with the law. So there is a certain level of confusion out there right now. We have federal law, we have federal administrative rules, we have current law and current administrative rules that need to be amended to be in compliance with it. And the districts are needing that direction and that clarification.
And if I may ask a question a different way.
Yes, Mr. Navarro.
The money that is going with the bill, the $481,000 fiscal, we were told there's a revenue impact. We don't have a statement of that. Does that money go to the local school district?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Byers, as Mr. Osmond pointed out to me, the issue is that we do lose federal funding. Federal funding attaches to special education services for children and youth.
Does that money go to the local school district?
Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony.
Pete Johnson, front of Ed.
Good evening, committee. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Johnson, Associate Superintendent, Office of Special Education, Oregon Department of Education. Joining me today is Susie Harris, Legal Specialist with the Office of Special Education. We are here to testify in support of Senate Bill 363 and its accompanying amendments. This is conforming legislation that brings Oregon statutes in line with federal requirements. The bill you have in front of you and the accompanying amendments are based on careful and deliberate review and consideration of federal requirements and state needs, and most importantly, the needs of students with disabilities, their parents, and those who provide education to them. This bill has been formed with the input from many groups and individuals, and it has support of many of those groups. We've talked with the Oregon School Boards Association. They've indicated their support. You'll hear shortly from another major organization in the state. This legislation adheres closely to federal requirements. Generally, we do not exceed federal requirements unless there is precedent in Oregon. The two proposed amendments are ones that we support. They provide for some technical amendments to the drafted bill, and they also allow for continued service for students already receiving special education through the year 2006.
This also allows districts to continue to receive the funding that is needed to educate these students. This bill, which brings us into compliance with federal requirements, does represent approximately $94 million of federal funds for the next biennium. 90% of that money does flow through directly based on the numbers of students being served to local school districts throughout the state. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nick, what's the age requirement that we have to cover under the federal law for special education?
Representative Starr, Representative Mannix, the federal requirement that's mandated is ages 3 through 18. Because Oregon statute does provide for service up through 21, we will continue to provide it.
I understand that. I just wanted to make that clear, that Oregon traditionally has provided additional service beyond the age of 18, but federal law does not require that.
Right.
So we don't need conforming amendments to say that prisoners in adult correctional institutions get special ed after the age of 18, do we?
Representative Starr, Representative Mannix, to the extent that Oregon provides education for other students beyond the age of 18, we cannot act in a discriminatory fashion without this enabling legislation.
But we can act in a discriminatory fashion if they're incarcerated in the adult correction facility, isn't that correct?
Yes.
But the A7 amendments would back away from it.
Representative Starr, Representative Mannix, yes, what it would do is continue to provide services only for those individuals who are currently involved in education, so it would involve a phase out for all other students.
Thank you. Just
I'm Susie Harris, legal specialist with the Department of Education. I will say that the A7 amendments came out of some discussion on the Senate side about fairness related to students who had planned to graduate this year and next year who had not had an opportunity to plan their education in a way to take this into consideration, that their rights to special education would be cut off at graduation. So this was an attempt to accommodate that group of students.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I respectfully suggest that if they'd not gone out and committed a crime, you shouldn't have to worry about fairness. So I'm not very sympathetic. I understand your position.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any other areas of this bill that Oregon law is going beyond federal mandate?
Representative Starr, Representative Beyer, I'll ask Susie Harris to address that issue.
I would say that we are not aware of any other place that we're exceeding the federal requirements. So we try to very much mirror those regulations, and I think we've done a good job of that. There are some optional components of the federal law and regulations which states can opt in and out of. One of those options was limiting rights beyond age 18 for students in adult correctional facilities, and we have chosen that option in this bill. There is another option related to transfer of rights at age 18 to students, and that option is in this bill. So it doesn't mean we're going beyond federal law. It means we're taking advantage of certain flexibility contained in the federal law and opting in for those things. Much of what you see in this bill is just technical compliance. It's implementing what we're required to do under federal law.
Mr. Chairman, did you follow up?
Yes, I did.
Go ahead.
Is the money that's coming with this bill going to the districts? Would the districts receive that money without this bill? I'm very concerned about it because I know that school districts are spending an enormous amount of money, or in many cases, in the school district that my children go to school in, the districts will not excel students or will not take them out of the class for disciplinary reasons because they lose the money, or they have to pay for special education, private education outside of the school environment. And we've got a bunch of people running around the school district who should be probably in jail, but instead they're still in the school. And the way I see this bill, it says that it
you know, clarifies that school districts remain obligated to provide education to a service, education to child with disabilities who is expelled for a weapons violation. So if you know, that's, to me, ridiculous. That I want to make sure this is a federal mandate, and if we're going one inch beyond that, I will do everything we can to stop this issue.
Representative Starr, Representative Beyer, if we fail to pass this legislation, we are unable to assure the U.S. Department of Education that we are in compliance and should receive the federal funding. In addition, if we fail to pass this legislation, we expose districts throughout the state to additional lawsuits brought on behalf of students with disabilities. So, in fact, we jeopardize more than the $94 million over the next biennium. No, we are not exceeding federal requirements in the area of discipline. It is of major concern to the Department of Education, of major concern to school districts and to teachers and to parents throughout the state. We are attempting to address in a very responsible way ways in which to create safe schools for all students and to assure fair treatment for kids with disabilities.
One more, Ms. Carroll.
If I could make one more comment related to that. There's nothing in this bill that precludes school districts from making referrals to law enforcement agencies for children with disabilities as they would for children who are not disabled.
Yes. My fault would be then, is the federal money that the schools receive, is it enough to pay for the private education of disciplinary problem students to pay that it would excel if they choose to do so?
Representative Starr, Representative Beyer, the money would be available to pay for the necessary education, whether it be a separate program that the district set up or a private schooling. Whether it's sufficient, I can't answer that because it would all depend on the numbers of students who require such service.
Thank you very much. Wilma Wells.
Chair Simmons and members of the committee, for your record, I'm Wilma Wells. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I'm here speaking in support of Senate Bill 363. I was a member of that committee, of that constituent team that looked at the federal statute. I assure you that in all cases did the committee do its level best to see that we did not exceed any federal statute, and that in fact what we did was to try to take advantage of those things where we could cut back. That's briefly what I have to say. There were advocates, there were school district representatives, there were school board representatives invited to the constituent 18 meetings. They were all led by the Department of Education's legal specialist, and we had the material back to us before we met the next time so we could look at what was being proposed at that point. So I will not take any more of your time tonight. I suggest that it would be a good idea to pass this bill out since $94 million is not peanuts.
I agree with that. Is there any questions for Mr. Cole? Thank you very much for your testimony tonight.
Madam Chair, excuse me.
That's okay. Anyone else with testifying Senate Bill 363 tonight? Seeing none, we'll close to the public hearing on Senate Bill 363.
Go to House Bill 2332. Go to the hearing, House Bill 2332. Your work session only, okay? We're going to go to the Senate Bill 16 and then that's 2332. 2332.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Navarro.
You're in a work session on 2332.
We are.
I would move the dash two amendment.
Okay, can you have an overview of the desk in a minute?
Are you happy to speak to him?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the DAS 2 amendments were worked out, and I believe everyone is in agreement with them. I can't speak for the Employment Department, but I know that everyone else that works in the group is, and the Employment Department would happy to nod or shake their head one way or another. But let's sit there and do nothing, which means that they don't care. The DAS 2 amendments would require the Employment Department to seek a waiver to pilot project in Plaquemines, Marion, Washington, and Yamhill counties to keep the number of referrals absolute minimum. Okay? In the absence of such waiver, by January 1st of 2000, the department shall report to the emergency board, and at that point in time, the emergency board shall say that task force shall be set up. That would be 11-member task force, and this task force shall then look into ways that they could do that and take on a study finding out ways that they could do that to minimize the number of referrals of illegal immigrants. That's basically the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Could we hear from the Employment Department, which I guess that wasn't a head nod?
Just briefing has been with the local government here.
And one other question, if I could, of the committee administrator, do we have a fiscal on that?
No. Let me take that back. No, sir. We've got these amendments about 2 o'clock or something. We need to have a fiscal, but that's one of their concerns. If I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
There's no provision in this bill for funding. And that was done deliberately because not knowing the extent or scope of the waivers, there's really no way to price it out. And not knowing whether or not there would be waivers, there's no way to price it out. If there are no waivers, then there's the task force. And there's no cost to the waivers, but some administrative cost to the task force. It was my belief in asking LC as they drafted these to have the department go to the emergency board before the end of the year and have the emergency board decide on what they heard, whether they had the waivers and deal with funding at that time at the emergency board level, or not having the waivers and figuring out they couldn't get them to deal with whatever funding might be necessary to do the task force. Now, the department has also told me that a possibility exists, only a possibility, and they don't have an answer yet at this point, that they might possibly be able to apply for and receive LEAD Act monies to do either the waivers or possibly the task force. They don't know the answer to that question at this point. There were a couple of other issues that are not so much concerns, is that I feel the committee's discussion is that nothing in this bill should construe that they aren't to pursue other solutions to the problem of an inadequate labor force, and they have testified that they were doing some work on that. We don't want them to do anything that would jeopardize federal funds, and that there is no fixed time period for the pilot project. That's going to be subject to what it is you're going to negotiate out if there are any waivers. And I think those are the issues we concerned that had, and I think with the record, and except for funding with the READ Act, this is a... So I'm not allowed to say that. I think that's the concern.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator with the Employment Department. I will be brief. Thank you for the opportunity to comment for the record. Mr. Putnam has summarized the majority of the concerns. The department and the governor would very much like to see the task force look at the issue of employment eligibility confirmation and improving that. And we do believe that's a little bit broader than what the mission statement is for the task force, but we believe that would be actually the broader way to address the issue of the problems the agricultural industry has brought to the committee. And we would continue to work on refining this bill. There are still a few policy implications and fiscal concerns about the process. If the pilot program were implemented in the four counties, it would take approximately four to five FTE and about $500,000, which we would need to receive position authority and funding for. We can work with the Senate side to get potential amendments that would authorize us to accept READAC dollars if they were available, but otherwise we need to have some discussion of the fiscal impact of the bill. We continue to have legal concerns, but we are working on those with our national office, and I believe Mr. Putnam has distributed, and we also have additional copies of a memo we sent to the Regional Department of Labor asking them the questions that this committee asked us at a previous hearing. And we would put on the record as well that we're concerned about the reference to the word that the department would establish that the applicant is legally authorized to work. Mr. Chair, Mr. Putnam and I have had a discussion that there is no way, even more than employers can, that we can guarantee that the records demonstrate that the person is legally authorized. We will do our best to establish the documents are authentic as employers are required to do, and we would adopt that same approach. The last piece that we're a little bit concerned about is the fact that the one-stop, which is the new workforce role of that this committee addressed earlier this session on the Workforce Investment Act, it means lots of different departments will be doing referrals, not just the Employment Department. So we won't be the only agency doing employment referrals in those counties. In addition, we will be doing a lot of referrals in a technological way as opposed to requiring people to come into our office. We are more than willing to work with the members to try to address those issues as this bill progresses through the process. As I said, the governor and the department would certainly like the task force to go forward, if nothing else, and also to see the broader issue of how we help employers confirm employment eligibility.
Chairman?
Yep.
I would like to note these concerns for the record, and be happy to continue working with the Employment Department. This is a House bill. If we are going to have any action at all, we need to move this bill. I would have Mr. Putnam and the representative of the nursing industry is here. We can, I'm sure we've got the concerns on the record now. We can work on those in the Senate, and we will address those concerns that the department brought, but we do need to move something forward. I would also like to put on the record that if the bill does, in fact, continue to move and get out of the Senate, I will also ask for an emergency clause to be put on it so that if the bill does become law, the Employment Department will have more than like the 1st of December to the end of December to do that. That's something we can get out of here until sometime August.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, are we in one session? Do you have a motion to move?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have the action, Thomas?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to state for the record that I share some of the concerns of the Employment Department with the assurances of my colleague here to my right. I'd be happy to, you know, sort it out today, and we'll see what happens on the Senate side.
Okay. All right. We have a motion before us then to move the dash twos. Any further discussion or objection? Seeing none, dash twos are adopted. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2332 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Okay. We have a motion before us to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Kaplan.
Aye.
Representative
Edwards. Aye.
Representative
Gardner.
Aye.
Representative
Manning.
Aye.
Representative
Starr.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman. Aye. The volunteers for carrier.
I'm just happy to see
Representative
Byer. Thank you.
Representative. We'll now go to the Senate bill. Close the bill goes before the due pass recommendation, and we'll close the work session and go to Senate Bill 16 and open the work session on Senate Bill 16. Okay, and Representative Byer, you took time to meet with the proponent for this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have met with both the opponents and the proponents. And actually, I don't even know if we have opponents if we don't include amendments. But and after going to legislative council at least once, and the committee administrator went down a couple different times to draft some different amendments, I think the proponents of the bill decided that maybe amendments aren't needed as long as we make it clear for the record that emergency services would include what is in 7443.699 for care of emergency services, and then you have a statement in your packet explaining what is coverage under emergency services. I think in my discussions with the optometrist, not directly, but their lobbyist, assuming he talks to the optometrist directly, that the bill as is would be sufficient. Okay. With that, I would move Senate Bill 15 to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Okay. You have a motion to the floor, colleagues. Head nods all around. And any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Byers. Aye. Representative Edwards. Aye. Representative Charger. Aye. Representative Matt. Aye. Representative Carter. Aye.
And Senate Bill 15 goes before the House. We'll do tax recommendation, volunteers for carrier.
Representative Starr would be the carrier,
and the work session is closed on Senate Bill 15. Yes, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 363. We heard that just a few moments ago.
Mr. Chair. Under the A6 amendments to Senate Bill 363.
Okay, colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the six amendments to Senate Bill 363 are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
President Starr.
I move Senate Bill 363 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
The colleagues have the motion before us to move. Any discussion on the A7? What was the decision there?
Adverse comment.
Yes.
I'm getting mouth comments from my friend Jim Green from the Schoolwork Association.
Mr. Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. On the A7, lines 11 through 15 of those, the first part of the A7 that Representative Maddox and I believe Representative Byer had some concerns and questions about, that's a policy decision for you to make whether we go beyond the federal law and take this option. But lines 11 through 15 we do need in the bill in order to be in compliance with the federal law. On page 6 of the printed A, Rose Bill.
Yes, Representative Maddox.
Just to speed this up, I had read through that and I wondered if that was something you guys supported or they had just come in sideways on, and since that's what you want, I have no problem with that. If you will, Mr. Chairman, may I make a motion?
Yes.
I move that we adopt only part of the A7 amendments, which is the changes listed on lines 11 through 15 of the A7 amendments.
Okay, colleagues, we would draw a line around the lines 11 through 15, which is the last part of that amendment, the A7, and adopt only that portion. That's the motion before us, colleagues. Any discussion? Any objection to that motion? Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
President Starr.
Again, I would move Senate Bill 363 as amended to
the floor. The colleague's motion to move the bill as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
President Byer.
My only discussion would be that I recognize that school districts say they need the bill. I'm very concerned about what's going on in schools right now, at least schools in my district where they are. I'm willing to discipline students because they're afraid that they will either lose the funding for that student or they will have to provide an alternative education for that student outside of the building, and it will be much more expensive than what providing education in the building. So what they're in fact doing is they're putting all the rest of the students at risk in the building at the expense of what it may cost to deal with one student outside the building. And I don't know how we can fix that, but that is one of the things that I've on my accountability package that I presented to the speaker to school
Well, I would like to see in schools is to somehow deal with the problem there is with the discipline in the schools, and it seems this bill does the exact opposite, so I can vote for this bill under somewhat of a concept of what I think is my sense of right and wrong.
Okay. Anyone else? Call the roll.
Representative
Byer. Representative Aye.
Representative
Edwards. Aye.
Representative
Edwards. Aye. Representative Gardner. Aye.
Representative
Mann. Aye.
Representative
Trump. Aye. Aye. Do you want to know the two pieces of business that we can do? We need a carrier for that bill. Representative Edwards, do you care to carry that bill?
Sure.
Okay. Senate Bill 487. Representative Patrick did have another amendment drafted to that bill. That's an important bill. And we had a lot of discussion about this the other day. Is there any further movement on the committee?
Opposition or opposition to the bill?
Yeah, 47.
Mr. Chair, I think the one movement was that some of my colleagues who were opposed to the bill are no longer on the committee. So I thought maybe that was the signal that I was supposed to change my opinion. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you like a motion, I'll move Senate Bill 487 with lower to do that.
Okay, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 487. And we have a bill before us, and you should have in your package demanding growth amendments into the bill, and that amendment that also includes A6, I understand.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir, please.
As I understand it, we adopted A3, A4, and A5.
Correct.
Now we have the Representative Patrick Lawyers Love Due Process Amendment.
Yes, and I'm not entirely, first blush, I wasn't entirely thrilled with the A6.
I'm not offering it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I'll pause for a moment and see if anyone else is urgently trying to offer it.
I think the moment's over.
All right, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
I move the bill to the floor as already amended with a due pass recommendation.
As was previously amended without the new A6s. So a motion before its colleagues to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion on the bill?
I think you know my position, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Byer. First of all, we call the roll.
Representative Byer.
No.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative
Edwards. Aye for now.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Representative Mann.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative.
Aye. And Senate Bill 47 goes to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. And I will delay signing the carrier's bill. And then maybe it makes it. We will now open a public hearing on House Front Resolution 17 and call Representative Westland.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Do we anticipate a work session on this tonight?
I would like to go to work session on this bill this evening.
I'd be happy to expedite that, or
I would just let the record show Representative Ben Westland. It's a bill I support. It is intended to put the ticker that we so either dearly love or dearly hate in the Constitution. This was passed by the voters of the state of Oregon statutorily in 1979 by a 9-1 margin. And I actually support the kicker. And I think everyone in this budgetary climate today should understand that had we done what every session wanted us to do, which was keep the kicker, today we would be faced in the best of economic times, we would be faced with a $1.2 billion shortfall. And we would be raising taxes just to provide current service levels. Not talking about the 8 or 9% increase that we budgeted, the K-12 budget. Not talking about the 12 or 15% budget increases that we've expanded the Oregon Health Plan. Just today, to provide current service level, we would be $1.2 billion underwater, and we would have to be raising taxes. I consider this a very important bill and a very important legislation for the future of Oregon. Thank you.
Representative Edwards?
Yes, thank you. To my good friend from Central Oregon, I guess one of the things that troubles me most about this is, once again, moving something into the Constitution. Could you describe why we need to amend the Constitution on a tax policy, one, and what is the current threat that you see to the current law, and therefore I assume that's why you want to put in the Constitution?
I think we spend a lot of unnecessary debate every session over something the people of Oregon voted on and approved, and that has demonstrated itself to be good fiscal and budgetary policy over the time that we've been here.
Mr. Chairman,
what's in that?
I see there's no provision for a legislative override in here, though, is there?
I don't believe so.
There is not?
There is not?
I do not believe so. I hadn't looked at the bill.
I believe that there is not.
There is not.
There is not.
I just want to...
I bet
there's no lifesaver.
Yeah, I will rely on the good representative from Lake Oswego's interpretation of the bill. There is not.
Nope.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Just to echo some of the thoughts of my colleague from Central Oregon, the kicker is the most popular tax relief program that Oregon has ever had. And I believe that it's time that we give the voters of Oregon the opportunity to vote on it, to protect themselves, and to make that tax relief permanent and put it out of the reach of the legislature so the legislature can't get its hands on the money. And I think we ought to trust the voters on this issue.
Mr. Chairman, for the questions that we make.
Would you support adding a legislative override if it required 3/5 of the Senate and 3/5 of the House to override it due to an anticipated emergency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I like to measure the way it is, and the reason I do is because that's the way it was originally written. I think you open yourself up for the possibility that voters will not pass it simply because the legislature has changed it or, quote, tampered with the way it currently is.
Of course, right now we can override it by a majority because the governor signs the bill. This would make it tougher to override it.
I think, I appreciate the question. I appreciate the spirit of the question. What I would appreciate this evening is a work session, and perhaps we could fix this on the Senate side if that is that great a concern.
You might see a minority report. That's what I'm concerned about.
Mr. Chair, I was under the understanding this would probably have to go to Ways and Means anyway.
I believe it has a significantly proactive for revenue. And we have a request from the Speaker's office that that be rescinded.
Are you ready for a work session?
Yes, I am ready for a work session. So what I'm going to do is go to a close the public hearing and open a work session on HCR 17, and I'll take a motion that we move the bill for the due pass recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to revenue in that motion. Mr. Barr, do you so move?
So move, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, the motion before us. Just a comment, I just continue to think that we don't need to be cluttering our Constitution with collective bargaining agreements, property tax law, and every other form of law in the Constitution. If you look at the U.S. Constitution, it has only been amended a few number of times compared to the Oregon Constitution, which we constantly amend every 2 years, either by referral or by initiative. And I'll be a no on it, and I will serve notice of a possible intent of a minority report.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
I love the Oregon Constitution. It is truly the people's constitution. It is accessible to the people, and it is malleable and movable, but we always have the bedrock protections of the U.S. Constitution, and we can extend those protections if we wish, and we can protect ourselves from those who are elected officials who sometimes may get a little bit out of line through that constitutional process. And the beauty is that we can change the Constitution, not easily, but more easily than the U.S. Constitution. We should always be cautious and make sure that what we do with the Constitution is appropriate. But this is the kind of thing that the voters can appreciate and respect and support, and we're simply giving them an opportunity to reinvigorate that which they have already passed.
And reaffirm that which they've already passed.
I'm disappointed that we might not see some sort of override provision for an emergency in what's in front of us. I'll support what's in front of us, but I'd fire the yellow flare and indicate, watch out for a Minerva report that includes an override. But I would say, it better say at least a free set of vote if it's going to have a spare on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After prolonged and considered discussions with my esteemed colleagues from Central Oregon, we have agreed that if the good representative from Portland would withdraw his potential notice of a minority report, we would be happy to go with the override provision if he's capable of that.
Mr. Chairman?
What's that, Devlin?
If the sponsors as well would be willing to do that, I'll talk to my two members here who are going to offer the minority report in just a second. So
we will stand at ease momentarily.
It's going to take longer than until our next meeting to get such an if we could get that language drafted tomorrow, we'll reduce it to 2/3. There will be no minority reports, and there still may be 2 no votes on the committee, but there will be no minority reports.
Okay. Is it the, can we, by unanimous consent, suspend the rules and put that in?
We could, Mr. Chairman, if there's
I know Representative Maxwell and others probably know the words by heart, so if we can do it conceptually, that'd be fine.
So, okay, and it's pretty straightforward.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd request unanimous consent that we suspend the rules for purposes of adopting an amendment. A conceptual amendment.
Okay. We have a request, colleagues, that we suspend the rules for purposes of adopting a conceptual amendment, HR 17. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Mann.
I move as a conceptual amendment to House Senate Resolution 17, a provision which can be technically drafted by Legislative Council, which would provide that the Legislative Assembly, by vote of a 2/3 majority of the House and by vote of a 2/3 majority of the Senate, may determine that an emergency exists and may override the kicker provisions for the immediate biennium in which they apply, all or any portion of the kicker provisions for the biennium in which they immediately apply.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Mr. Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, that should be fine. I mean, to get a 2/3 vote, I don't think you have to define the circumstances. You'd have to have a pretty significant situation to get a 2/3 vote.
That's very accurate. Okay. Is there any further discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
I am troubled by 2/3, quite frankly. I don't think we have anything in statute that even comes close to that. This is typically, any tax proposal, which this is, would take 3/5, so I'm going to oppose the 2/3.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Byrne.
Aye.
Representative Dillon.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
No.
Representative Burton.
No.
Representative Hammond.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Chair Simmons.
Aye. And the motion carries. The bill is conceptually amended. Representative Starr. Do you have another motion for us? We had a motion pending, actually.
Yeah, I love the motion pending.
That's the motion again that we...
I move that we send the bill to the floor of the House with the Utah recommendation as amended, and we send subsequently for the revenue.
Okay, colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion?
Okay.
Hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative Byrne.
Aye.
Chair Representative Devon.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Nope.
Representative Gardner.
No.
Representative Manning.
Aye.
Representative Clark.
Aye.
Chair Kim.
Aye. And volunteers for Carrier?
I'd be happy to.
Okay, and we will assign the Griffin and Canope to the Carrier of Brazil, and see no other business for the committee this evening. We are adjourned.